This is a reading of the Agriculture course by Rudolf Steiner. This is Lecture 6, given in Kobervitz, Saturday, June 14th, 1924. Over the past few days, we have acquired some insights into the growth and development of plants and also of animals, and these insights will now provide a basis for our further considerations. We need now to take at least a brief look at some spiritual scientific ideas that relate to plants and animals as agricultural pests, and also to what are called plant diseases. In fact, very little can be said about these things in general terms. They can only be studied in concrete detail. What I will be doing, therefore, is giving examples, which may help you take things further if they serve as points of departure for experiments. I would like to begin by dealing with weeds. For us, the definition of a weed is less important than the insight into how unwanted plants can be eliminated from specific areas. Indeed, do you know how people sometimes get strange impulses, hearkening back to their student days? Well, in the grip of one of those impulses, I took a half-hearted look in a couple of textbooks to see how they defined weeds. Most authors, I found, try to do it by saying that a weed is anything that grows where you don't want it to. This sort of thing does not bring us much closer to the essence of the matter, and in fact, we will never have much luck in finding the essence of a weed, simply because, in the eyes of nature, a weed has just as much right to grow as any plant we consider useful. We have to look at these things from a somewhat different point of view. The question for us is how we can keep some specific plant from growing in a certain area where it grows naturally under the prevailing conditions. We cannot answer this question without taking into account the things we've dealt with in the past few days. We have seen the need to make strict distinctions among the forces active in plant growth. On the one hand, there are the forces that actually originate in the cosmos, but which are first absorbed into the earth and then work on the plants from there. These forces, which, as I indicated, essentially originate from the cosmic influences of Mercury, Venus, and the Moon, but which work in a roundabout way via the earth, rather than directly from the planets, these are the forces we need to take into account when we trace how one generation of plants leads to the next. On the other hand, in everything plants acquire from the periphery, from what is above the earth, we need to look to the various effects that the distant planets transmit to the air, and which are taken up in that way. Furthermore, we can say that everything coming from the near planets, in the way of forces working into the earth, is heavily influenced by the lime in the earth, while everything coming from the distant periphery is influenced by the silica. And even when the silica influences proceed from the earth itself, they will transmit what comes from Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn, and not what comes from Moon, Mercury, and Venus. Nowadays we are not in the habit of taking these things into account, but we're also having to pay for it. In one recent instance, ignorance of the cosmic influences, both insofar as they work through the air by way of everything above ground, and also insofar as they are mediated by the earth from below, such ignorance had to be paid for in many parts of the civilized world. In these places, everything that used to be done out of the old instinctive science had run out. The soil was exhausted, and the agricultural traditions were exhausted too, even though sometimes the peasants were still able to help. What happened may not be a concern to you, but it affected many, many people. Far and wide, vineyards were infested with grape phylloxera, and there was practically nothing anyone could do about it. Phylloxera, P-H-Y-L-L-O-X-E-R-A. I still remember how the editors of an agricultural periodical in Vienna in the 1880s were bombarded with requests to find a means of combating the grape phylloxera, and how they were at a complete loss as to what to do when the infestation became acute. These things cannot be dealt with effectively by the science available today. The only effective way to deal with them as to delve into what can be learned along the lines we have indicated. Let me show you this schematically, and there's a drawing. Suppose this is ground level, and this is what works in from the cosmos from Venus, Mercury, and Moon, and which then radiates back so that it works from below upward. What works into the ground in this way brings the plants to produce what grows in a single year and then culminates in seed formation. Out of this seed, there then comes a new plant and then a third plant and so on. Everything that comes from the cosmos in this way flows into the plant's ability to reproduce, into the succession of generations. On the other hand, everything that comes in a different way, from above the surface of the earth, comes from different forces, from the forces of the distant planets. Let me sketch it in. Here is what transforms itself in the plant in such a way that the plant expands outward and looks nice and plump. This is what we can remove for our nourishment, because there is a continuous stream building it up again. The parts we eat, the fleshy parts of apples or peaches, for example, all come from the effects of the distant planets. Knowing this, we can tell what we have to do in order to influence plant growth in a particular direction. Taking these different forces into account is the only way to gain insight into how to affect the growth of plants. Now, a large number of plants, especially the ones we usually call weeds, even though some of the most powerful medicinal plants are found among them, are very strongly influenced by what we can call the lunar effects. It is common knowledge that the surface of the moon reflects the rays of the sun, directing them back toward the earth. We see these reflected rays of the sun because we catch them with our eyes, and the earth catches them too. The rays of the moon are reflected sun rays, but the moon has imbued them with its own forces, and so they strike the earth as lunar forces, and have been doing so ever since the moon separated from the earth. This lunar force from the cosmos has an intensifying effect on everything earthly. When the moon was still united with the earth was indeed much more alive and fruitful. The earth is more mineralized at present, and is only barely strong enough to bring about growth in living things. Ever since the moon separated itself, however, it works to intensify the normal condition of the earth so that growth can be enhanced to reproduction. When a living being grows, it gets big. The force at work in growth is also at work in reproduction. In the case of growth, however, it doesn't go far enough to produce a separate organism. Instead, it simply brings forth cell after cell. Growth is a weaker form of reproduction, a reproduction that remains within the organism. And reproduction is an enhanced form of growth. By itself, the earth can impart the weaker form of reproduction, that is, growth. But without the moon, it cannot produce the enhanced growth. This requires the cosmic forces that shine down on the earth from the moon. And in the case of some planets, and in the case of some plants, from Mercury and Venus as well. As I said before, we usually imagine that the moon simply takes up the rays of the sun and reflects them onto the earth. In other words, when we consider the effects of the moon, we usually think only of the sunlight. But that is not the only thing that comes toward the earth. Along with the moonbeams, the entire reflected cosmos comes toward the earth. The moon reflects everything that comes toward it. In a certain sense, the whole starry heavens are reflected by the moon and stream toward the earth, although you couldn't prove it by any physical means available at present. It is indeed a very powerful cosmic organizing force that radiates down from the moon into the plants, so that the plants are also enabled to form seeds, so that the force of growth can be enhanced to become the force of reproduction. Now, for a given location on Earth, all this is available only at full moon. At new moon, that area does not receive the benefit of the lunar influences. What the plants received at the last full moon will persist, but that's all. We could achieve significant results if already at planting time, for instance, we were to utilize the moon to support early germination, if we were to sow according to the phases of the moon, as people in India did well into the 19th century. But nature is not so cruel as to punish us for the slightly inattentive and discourteous way we treat the moon with regard to sowing and harvesting. We have full moon 12 times a year. This suffices to ensure that there are always enough full moon effects, that is, enough of the forces that promote fruit formation. If we undertake any fertility measures at new moon instead of at full moon, they simply wait in the earth until the next full moon, disregarding our human error and taking their cue from nature. Thus people use the moon without knowing it, but they don't get any further. You see, under such circumstances, the weeds demand their rights just like the cultivated plants. We get everything confused because we are unacquainted with the forces that regulate growth. We must enter into them. Once we do, we realize that the fully developed lunar forces work for the reproduction of every kind of plant life. In other words, they encourage what shoots up from the root, right up into the seed formation. We would get the best stand of weeds if we were to simply let the beneficent moon have its effect on them and did not hinder it in any way. The weeds would reproduce and multiply, especially in wet years when the lunar forces work best. However, when we take these cosmic forces into account, we will realize the following. If we prevent the moon from exerting its full influence on the weeds, if we allow them to be influenced only from outside by the direct non-lunar influences, their proliferation will be curbed. They will not be able to reproduce. Thus, what we need to do, since we can't simply switch off the moon, is to treat the soil so that it will become unsuitable for absorbing the lunar influences. And not only the soil, but also the plants, these weeds, can acquire a certain reluctance to grow in soil that has been treated in a certain way. If we can accomplish that, we'll have what we want. So if we see weeds making headway in a given year, we must simply accept the fact and calmly resolve to take action. We must gather a number of seeds from these weeds, since the force I have been talking about is ultimately enclosed in the seeds. We then light a fire, a simple wood fire is best, and burn the seeds and carefully collect whatever ashes are left. We will not get very much of this ash in this manner, but there, literally concentrated in the ashes of these seeds, we now have the opposite force to what is developed in the attraction of the lunar forces. We then take this little preparation, which we've made in this way from the various weeds, and scatter it over our field. These things have a large radius of influence, so we don't even need to be terribly careful about this. We will notice already by the second year that there are far fewer of the kinds of weeds we treated in this way, and that they are no longer growing as well. And since there is a cycle of 4 years with many things in nature, we'll see after the fourth year that those weeds that we have treated by scattering this pepper each year will not be found in this field. You see, here you have an example of the fruitful application of the effects of smallest entities, which have now been demonstrated scientifically by our Biological Institute. A great deal could be achieved in this way. If you take into account these influences, which are totally ignored today, you can have control over any number of things. For instance, you can feel quite free to plant as much dandelion as you need for the purposes I mentioned yesterday. But you can also burn its seeds and scatter the pepper over your fields. You would then be able to have the dandelions exactly where you wanted them, yet keep your treated fields free of them. Although people today will not believe it, things like this used to be known and mastered out of an instinctive agricultural wisdom. In those days, because people did such things instinctively, they could plant together in quite limited areas everything they wanted. In all these instances, I am simply giving you indications to serve as starting points for applying these things in actual practice. Since people these days are of the opinion, I don't want to call it a prejudice, that everything has to be verifiable, well, you should go ahead and try to verify them. But, excuse me, if you do the experiments properly, they will, surely, be confirmed. But if I had a farm myself, I would not wait for the confirmation. I would start right away, because I am quite sure these things work. As far as I am concerned, spiritual scientific truths are true in and of themselves, and do not need to be confirmed by other circumstances or external methods. Our scientists have all made the mistake of looking to external methods, of wanting to verify spiritual scientific truths by external methods. This has happened even within the Anthroposophical Society, where people should have known that things can be true of themselves. But in order to get anywhere nowadays, we have to verify these things outwardly. We have to compromise. A compromise is necessary here, but in principle it's not necessary. For how do you know inwardly that something is true? You know it by virtue of its inner quality. You know it for certain, as certainly as you know, for instance, that if it takes 50 people to manufacture something, and you decide you want to produce 3 times as much, that you need 150 people. Of course, some smart aleck can come along and say, I don't believe that 150 people will make 3 times as much. We'll first have to put that to the test. It can then happen under certain circumstances that you are repudiated by experience, if actually experiment. Suppose you let whatever is involved be done first by one person, then by two, then by three, and then you determine statistically how much the three have produced. Now, if the three people spent all of their time talking with each other, then they will have gotten less done than one person. In that case, the assumption you made was false. The experiment can yield a contrary result. But that proves nothing. If you are proceeding carefully, you must also examine this contrary result quite exactly. Then what is inwardly true will also be confirmed outwardly. We have spoken in quite general terms about weeds, but this will not be as possible when it comes to animal pests. Let me choose here an example that can be especially characteristic in order that experiments can be made to show how these things are confirmed in practice. Let's take the farmer's best friend, the field mouse. What great lengths people go to in trying to get rid of field mice. You can read in agricultural books that people tried all kinds of phosphorus preparations, for instance, and then also a combination of strychnine and saccharin. Even more drastically, it has been suggested that the field mice be infected with typhus, which can be done by setting out a bait of mashed potatoes inoculated with certain bacilli, harmful only to rodents. Such things have been done, or at least recommended. People have tried all kinds of rather inhumane methods of doing in these innocent-looking little animals. I think even the government has had to intervene, because if you are using one of these methods, it does no good unless your neighbor does it too. The mice will just come over from the field next door. The government has to be called in to help so that everyone is forced to get rid of mice in the same way. The government is not interested in modifying its regulations. Regardless of whether the method chosen is right or not, everybody has to go along with it. The government is not interested in anybody's promises. The issue must be decided for everyone. Everything must be done uniformly. Uniformity, after all, is the government's ideal. All of this experimentation and regulation is very superficial. You always get the feeling that the experimenters themselves aren't quite happy about it, because in the end, the mice always come back. Now, in our case, too, what we need to do is not something that can really be restricted to a single farm, though even there it will help. It won't be a full success, however, unless you can share your insight and persuade your neighbors to do these things too. I am convinced that in the future we will have to rely much more on shared insights than on regulations enforced by the police. That will be a real step forward for society. Now, what you have to do is catch a fairly young mouse and skin it. There are always plenty of mice around, but for this experiment it must be a field mouse. It's important to obtain this mouse skin in the period when Venus is in the sign of the scorpion. Those old-time farmers with their instinctive science were not so foolish after all, because as soon as we leave the plant kingdom and turn to the animals, we come to the zodiac, which means animal circle. When you are trying to accomplish something in the plant world, you can stay within the solar system. But that is not enough when it comes to animals. There, we need concepts that take into account the fixed stars, especially the fixed stars in the zodiac. With plants, the effect of the moon by itself is just strong enough to push the growth process over into reproduction. But in the animal kingdom, the moon's effect has to be supported by Venus. With animals, we don't need to give much consideration to the effects of the moon, because they preserve the lunar forces within themselves and emancipate themselves from the moon. In other words, the forces of the moon are developed and available in the animal kingdom, even when it isn't full moon. The full moon force in the animal is emancipated in regard to time. But this is not the case with respect to the other planetary forces, and this is what concerns us now. You must burn the skin of the mouse when Venus is in the scorpion, and carefully collect the ash and anything else that is left over. There won't be much, but if you catch a number of mice, you will get enough. What is destroyed through fire at the time when Venus is in the scorpion contains the negative of the field mouse's reproductive force. Then take the pepper you have made in this way and scatter it on your fields. If this is difficult to do in certain cases, you can make the pepper more homeopathic. You don't need a whole plateful. If the pepper has properly gone through the fire when Venus and Scorpion are in peak conjunction, then in this pepper you will have a potent means of making the mice avoid the fields where it has been strewn. But these animals have a lot of nerve. They'll come right back and settle down in any unpeppered areas. In other words, although the effect radiates quite far, it can happen that one is not quite thorough enough. However, if everyone in the neighborhood does it, the results will certainly be dramatic. I venture to say you might even develop a taste for doing such things and come to enjoy them. Farms, like certain foods, taste better with a little pepper. It is important to get to the point where you can reckon with the effects of the stars without being the least bit superstitious. A lot of things that used to be a matter of knowledge have now degenerated into superstition, and it does no good to warm them up again. We have to start over again from knowledge, and it must be knowledge acquired in a spiritual way and not just by means of the physical senses. Now, what I have just described is how we can treat the soil to combat those field pests that can be reckoned among the higher animals. Mice are rodents, so they are considered higher animals. But this method will have no effect against insects, because insects and other lower animals are subject to a totally different set of cosmic influences. I am going to tread on thin ice now, and in connection with what I have been talking about, use the sugar beet nematode as an example, in order to speak about something current and local. The first sign of its presence are the well-known swellings of the rootlets, and also the fact that the leaves remain wilted in the morning. That is the outer indication. It must be clear that this leafy middle region, which is what undergoes a change in this case, absorbs the cosmic influences from the air, but that the roots absorb the forces that come into the plant from the cosmos by way of the soil. What happens when nematodes appear is that the process of absorbing the cosmic forces, which should otherwise be taking place in the leafy part of the plant, is forced downward into the region of the roots. Indicated diagrammatically, if this is the surface of the soil and this is a nematode-infested plant, the cosmic forces that ought to be working up above are actually working here below. The real phenomenon is that certain cosmic forces slide too far down, and this is what causes the change in the plant's outward appearance. The cosmic forces that nematodes need for their survival are therefore available down in the ground, where the nematodes have to live. These little thread-like worms would otherwise have to live up in the leaves, and since the soil is their natural habitat, they cannot do that. Certain living things, or actually all living things, can only live within a certain range of conditions. Just try living in air that is 70 degrees Celsius or minus 7 degrees Celsius. 70 degrees Celsius, you'll find that you are totally dependent on a certain temperature range. Above or below this range, you can no longer survive. Nematodes have similar limitations. They can only live in the soil, and only if cosmic forces are present there at the same time. Otherwise, they die out. Each living thing requires quite specific conditions for its survival. The human race would die out, too, if the right conditions weren't present. For creatures that live in the particular way that nematodes do, it is crucial that the cosmic influences, which should otherwise be, are active only in the surroundings of the Earth, enter into the Earth. These cosmic influences have a 4-year cycle. With nematodes, we are dealing with something quite abnormal, something which we can also study, since the same forces are involved, by looking at the cockchafer grubs that appear every 4 years. The forces that give the Earth the capacity to develop the potato sprouts are the very same ones the Earth acquires for developing the cockchafer grubs, which appear among the potatoes every 4 years. Although this 4-year cycle is not apparent with the nematodes, it does appear in what you have to do to counteract them. With the insect, you must not take just part of it, as with the mouse, but rather the whole insect. A harmful root-dwelling insect like this is in its entirety a result of cosmic influences. It only needs the earth as a substratum. Here, you need to burn the whole insect. Burning it is the best and fastest way to go. You could also let it decay, but it is difficult to collect the end products of decomposition, although in some ways they might be better. In any event, you will certainly accomplish your objective by burning the whole insect. You may need to dry and store the insects. However, since the burning must be done when the sun is in the sign of the bull, which is exactly opposite the position Venus must be in when you make the mouse skin pepper, the whole insect world is related to the forces that develop as the sun moves through the waterman, fishes, ram, bull, twins, and on into the crab. Although by the time it gets to the crab, these forces are quite weak, as they also are when it is passing in front of the waterman. While the sun is moving through this part of the heavens, it is radiating forces that have to do with the insect world. People have no idea that the sun is actually a very specialized creature, and that it is not at all the same thing when in the course of the year or the day it shines down on the earth from the bull, or when it shines down from the crab, and so on. It is constantly changing, and in fact it is rather absurd, although forgivably so, to speak of the sun in general. We ought actually to say ram sun, bull sun, crab sun, lion sun, and so on. In each case, the sun is a quite different being, whose nature depends on the combined effects of its daily as well as its yearly course, which are determined by its position in the vernal point. So if you go through with this and make this insect pepper, you can then scatter it over your fields of root crops, and the nematodes will gradually become powerless. After the 4th year, you will certainly find that they have become quite powerless. They cannot survive. They shy away from life if they have to live in soil that has been peppered in this fashion. In a remarkable way, we have here before us what in earlier times was known as star knowledge. The knowledge of the stars that we have today only serves as a means of mathematical orientation. It's no longer much good for anything else. But that was not always the case. In ancient times, people saw something in the stars that could serve as a guide for their earthly life and work. That science has now been completely lost. You see, in this way, we now also have a possibility of keeping harmful animals and insects at bay. It is important to develop a relationship to the Earth where we know, on the one hand, that it is right that the Earth is enabled by the lunar and watery influences to bring forth plants. On the other hand, however, what is in the plant, what is in every living thing, also carries in itself the germ for its own destruction. Just as water is indispensable for fertility, so is fire a destroyer of fertility. Fire consumes fertility. Therefore, if something that is ordinarily treated with water in order to promote fertility is, instead, treated with fire, then, within the household of nature, you bring about the opposite, namely destruction. That is what has to be taken into account here. Under the influence of moon-saturated water, a seed develops fertility and proliferates. Under the influence of moon-saturated fire, or fire saturated with any other cosmic force, the same seed spreads a force of destruction, as we've seen. It is really not so strange that we can reckon here with strongly spreading forces, if we also take the effects of time into account quite precisely. After all, the force in the seed is a force that spreads out, and this works on, therefore, also in the destructive force. Just as the seed has an inherent tendency to spread out, so does the pepper that we produce from it. I call it pepper simply because of what it looks like. Most of these things do resemble pepper. Now, we still need to take a look at the so-called plant diseases. Actually, they should not be called plant diseases, because abnormal processes that occur in plants are not diseases in the same sense as they are in animals. We will understand this difference better when we come to talk about the animal kingdom. Most of all, plant diseases are not the same as disease processes in human beings. Actual illness is not possible without the presence of an astral body, which in an animal or a human being is connected with the physical body by means of the etheric body. There is a certain standard of normalcy for this connection, and most illnesses come about when the astral body unites unusually intensely with the physical body or some particular physical organ. That is, when the etheric body does not provide enough padding so that the astral body pushes its way into the physical body more strongly than usual. Now, since a plant does not contain an actual astral body, the particular way of being ill that is possible with animals and humans simply does not appear with plants. We must be quite aware of this fact, and then try to understand what actually can cause plants to become ill. From what I have said so far, you will have gathered that the soil around plants has a certain inherent vitality. Accompanying this vitality are all kinds of growth forces, faint suggestions of reproductive forces, and also all the forces working in this direction under the water-mediated influence of the full moon. Although these forces in the soil are not intense enough to appear as actual plant forms, they are present with a certain intensity all around the plants. There are several significant relationships involved here. First of all, you have the soil, and then the soil saturated with water. Then you also have the moon. By letting its rays stream into the soil, the moon makes the soil inherently alive to a certain extent. It induces waves in the etheric life of the soil. When the soil is saturated with water, it's easier for the moon to do this. When the soil is dry, it's more difficult. The water is actually only the mediator. To be sure, what must be enlivened in the solid earth, the mineral, but what... Let me read that again. To be sure, what must be enlivened is the solid earth, the mineral, but water, after all, is also something mineral. A sharp boundary, of course, does not exist here, so we also have the lunar influences in the soil. It can easily happen, however, that the lunar influences in the soil become too strong. Suppose you have a very wet winter followed by an equally wet spring. The lunar force will then penetrate too strongly into the earthy element, and the soil will become too strongly enlivened. I will indicate this over-enlivening of the soil with these little red dots, and there's a drawing. If these little red dots weren't there, if the soil had not been over-enlivened due to the moon, the plants growing above would develop normally, up to and including the process of going to seed. Imagine wheat or something like that growing and growing until it eventually forms seeds. If the moon imparts the right degree of vitality to the soil, this vitality works upward so that these seeds come into existence. Let us assume, however, that the moon's influence is too strong, that the soil is overly enlivened. In this case, the vitality works up too strongly from below, and something that should occur only in seed formation starts to happen earlier. When the vitality is too strong, it doesn't reach all the way to the top. Its very intensity makes it start working lower down. Thus, because of the effect of the moon, there is insufficient force for seed formation. The seed incorporates a kind of dying life into itself, and through this dying life, a kind of second ground level is formed above the level of the soil. Although there is no actual soil up there, the same influences are present. As a result, the seed, or the upper part of the plant, becomes a kind of soil for other organisms. Parasites and all kinds of fungi appear, blights and mildews and the like. What wants to work upward out of the soil is kept from reaching the right height because of the overly strong lunar force. It is remarkable that this happens when the lunar forces are too strong rather than too weak, but that's the way it is. A healthy seed-forming capability is absolutely dependent on the lunar forces being normal rather than too strong. Theorizing and speculation rather than perception might lead to the opposite conclusion, but that would be wrong. Direct perception reveals what I have just described. So, what should we do now? We need to relieve the soil of the excessive lunar force. We need to find some way of reducing the water's mediating capacity, of giving the soil more earthiness, so that the water that is present does not absorb the excess lunar influence. We accomplish this, though outwardly everything remains the same, by making a fairly concentrated tea out of Equisetum arvense, which we then dilute and use as a kind of liquid manure on the fields, where we want to combat blight and similar plant diseases. Once again, very small amounts, a kind of homeopathic application, will be sufficient. This is an instance where you can clearly see how the different fields of practical endeavor should interact. When you understand the remarkable effect that Equisetum arvense has on the human organism via the kidney function, you will have a guideline for working. You can't speculate about these things, of course, but this gives you a guideline for testing how Equisetum works when it is made into what I called a kind of liquid manure. When you spray it out, you don't need an apparatus here. It will work over wide areas, even if you spray only a little bit. You will find that it is an excellent remedy, although remedy is not quite the right word, since plants cannot actually get sick. It is not really a healing process. It is simply the opposite of the process I described earlier. In this way, if we acquire insight into the various aspects of nature's workings, it is entirely possible to take hold of the processes of growth, and as we shall see later, not only plant growth, but also the normal and abnormal growth of animals. Only at this point does real science begin. The type of experimentation current today is not real science. It is merely a recording of individual phenomena and isolated facts. Real science begins only when we are able to take hold of the effective forces. The plants and animals on earth, even the parasites of the plants, cannot be understood in isolation. As I said already in the first lecture, it is nonsense to seek, within the compass needle itself, the reason why it always points to the north. That is not done. The whole earth is considered. When a magnetic north pole and magnetic south pole are assigned, the whole earth is used in the explanation. But just as we have to look at the whole earth when we want to explain how a compass needle behaves, so must we also consult the whole universe when it comes to understanding plants. It is not enough to look only at the plant, animal, or human kingdoms. Life comes from the whole universe, not merely from what the earth provides. Nature is a unity, with forces working in from all sides. Those whose eyes are open to these manifest forces will be able to understand nature. But what does today's science do? It takes a little glass plate and puts a carefully prepared something or other on it, gets rid of everything else, and peers at it through something called a microscope. That is the exact opposite of what we ought to be doing if we want to comprehend the full dimensions of the world. It is bad enough to be shut up in a room, but now we shut out the whole glorious world with this tube. Nothing remains but what we see through the lens of the microscope. This is what we've gradually come to. But when we are able to find our way back to the macrocosm, then we will once again begin to understand something about nature, and about many other things too. The end of Lecture 6.